Like to open a Trade and Economic Committee of the Senate to order at this time. Today is what day is today? April 26, 1999. And we have a heavy agenda today. And then we hope to get through hopefully all this deal hopefully today. Like to open a public hearing and a work session of 2098, House Bill 2092. And is there any questions to this side? Okay. So why don't you give us what the bill does first? Okay. Brief description of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2092, AM Growth, was referred from the House. It is the bill which establishes the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Account within the Education Endowment Fund. It allows the ORTDA board flexibility to choose a state agency to assist them with administration. It states that the ORTDA and its board is a continuation of the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Fund, which was its predecessor, and its board.
Okay. We heard this bill before, right?
We have had information about the bill. We haven't heard the bill itself.
Okay. Could you come, Wayne and Rolly, please? Oh, okay. Is that right? Okay. Yeah.
Well, I thought I heard this bit.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock, Chief of Staff of the Oregon Treasury, and I have with me Cynthia Burns, who is the Attorney General that works with us on various technical issues for the Treasury. Okay. And Mr. Embry needs, I'm sure, no introduction. House Bill 2092. Basically resolves the problem that the Oregon, the ORTDF, the Resource Technology Development Fund, found itself in a short time ago. And the problem dealt with its ability to hold equities, stock. And just to step back just a little bit, the ORTDF is a creature of the Oregon legislature. It's a product of the Oregon legislature. A number of years ago, the legislature created the ORTDF to do venture capital funds in the state of Oregon. And Wayne was one of the people who spearheaded that effort, and I might say that it has been, you know, very successful, and particularly since the last time that they appeared before the legislature and were quasi-privatized, if I can
close enough.
They've been, I think, very successful in getting venture capital to businesses in the state of Oregon, in early stage seed capital. And they're the only ones that do this, and it has really helped a number of businesses. When you invest as a venture capitalist in a fund, there is an exit strategy that is required. If you invest your money as a venture capitalist, you have to get your money back out of that investment. And usually the way that you get your money out, or one of the ways you get your money out, predominantly is through stock. And ORTDF found themselves in the position that they could not hold the stock that had been targeted as their exit strategy. And then when they got the stock, they were told that they were potentially in violation of the law of the Oregon Constitution. That problem was not of their making specifically. But they were in a very difficult situation. The Oregon Treasury was brought in to see if we could assist by taking the ORTDF as part of the Oregon Growth Account, which was approved two biennia ago. We brought in Cynthia Burns at that time to assist us in trying to find a solution to the problem that ORTDF had, because we felt in our review of their investment strategies that they needed to continue to exist, that they were doing a great job with the state of Oregon, that they did something quite different from the Oregon Growth Account. They were dealing in seed capital, that really early stage capital where no one else was doing so.
Okay.
So we put our heads to together and tried to come up with a solution. And the solution that we came up with was to move the ORA TDF under the Educational Endowment Fund. That gave them the umbrella, gave them the authority to invest in equity. And it also, the solution, and I need to give Cynthia credit for the solution because it was really, you know, out of her brain that it sprang. It also allowed them to keep a board so that they had oversight, and it just was an excellent solution. And that's what we brought to the legislature with ORTDF, and we worked closely with the Department of Economic Development, and then I think all parties agreed that this was a very good solution to an ugly problem, a solution that met everybody's needs, and still allowed Oregon to have the benefit of venture capitalists out there.
Okay.
With that as a background, I'm going to step back and let Wayne say whatever he would like to say. And Cynthia is here with us to address any of the technical details, because it has a lot of technical parts to it, any technical details of the bill. But basically, it's simple. We're just moving ORTDF under the Educational Endowment Fund and giving them that protection.
Okay, Wayne, do you have anything to add to this bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Wayne Embry, general partner of Cascadia Pacific Management, where they contract managers of the Resource and Technology Development Fund. I provided to you a one-page summary of HB 2092, what's the brief description of the problem that Raleigh laid out and the solution. The bill came out of the House 60-0 in favor of passage. From our perspective, this is an elegant solution to a problem that needs to go away for the organization to continue functioning in the way that it was designed by the legislature to operate. And Raleigh's done a great job of explaining the background and the situation, and so we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Mr.
Chair. Mr. Wobbly.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. Mr. Embry, which House committee heard the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, it was the House Commerce Committee, started under the Subcommittee for Trade and Economic Development, and moved to the full committee.
Did they have one hearing or more?
They had multiple hearings.
And what issues or concerns were raised in those committee hearings?
The primary issues were, one, making sure that there was continuity for the operation of the fund, that the fund was going to be able to continue doing the investments that were outstanding right now would be able to roll over into future investments, and that the actual problem was going to be solved with respect to holding equity. And oversight, you know, that there was continued oversight. The fund has been audited every year by a combination of the Secretary of State and one of the major accounting firms, and that oversight process remains in place.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Now, Cynthia, do you have anything to add?
I really don't. I can walk you through the bill section by section if you'd like, or I can... That's what I thought you'd say.
Time. I see that it's a problem here, even though we like to. Why don't you give us a couple of just a high point?
20 pages?
Yeah.
As Raleigh said, basically what the bill does is create a new account within the Education Endowment Fund, and then the nomenclature in the bill is changed to talk about the account and a board that manages that account. There are no substantive changes. We simplified some things. We did some changes so that the distinctions between the rest of the Education Endowment Fund and how that is managed and this particular account, which is managed by a separate board, how those function together and have mutual reporting responsibilities and things like that. And then at the end, we have a bunch of operative provisions that basically says the existing board, which is the Oregon Resource Technology Development Fund board, is sort of reconstituted as the account board. The bodies stay the same. Everything just moves over. And that's pretty much it.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, is there any person like to testify on House Bill 2092? Thank you very much. If not, we'll close the public hearing in 2092. I'm going to open work session 2092. House Bill 2092.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2092 to the floor with the dispatch recommendation.
Excuse me. Yes. You said the subsequent referral to the committee.
Okay.
I should have a discussion for us. Okay. Okay. Senator Godley moved the House Bill 2092 to the Ways and Means with a two-pass recommendation. Okay. Any discussion?
The subsequent referral information is where?
Well, I have it on my folder from the original bill file.
Sure.
That's the basis of the subsequent two-way meeting. Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Then we'll so.
So, Mr. Chair,
are you sure that this is a 292? The 1021 might be a different. Is this working with this one?
Let's go.
I think this one is not.
Okay.
Okay, maybe this one is meant for 1020.
You can do that.
Okay.
You can.
There's no question. That is such a sure. I think after this point, if it is for the 1022, I think it is gone down.
I would read it the same way.
Okay. I don't think it's that. I don't think so. Okay. And then if it is not the password, we can restate it again?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, again, I move House Bill 2092. To the floor with the
due pass
recommendation.
Okay, so the move that the House Bill 2092 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And any discussion?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if not, call the roll, please.
Senator
Cortez? Aye.
Senator
Johnson? Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Bordley?
Aye.
Senator Lyons?
Aye. This House Bill 2092 passed. And I'm going to close a work session, right? We need to close a work session of House Bill 2092. And, any volunteers who will carry this bill to the floor?
I'm happy to do it.
Okay. Senator Godley will carry the bill. With that, and I'm going to open a House Bill 2247A, public hearing, and this is a secret public hearing or work session two? Okay, public hearing. And who is the person to testify on this one? Okay. Okay, thank you. I have here, let me see, Greg Smith, Port of Morrow. Greg, why don't you come on over? Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Chairman. I appreciate having the opportunity to come before you this morning. And I'm about to introduce...
Okay, why don't you say your name first, and then proceed. That's the procedure we have here.
Sure. My name is Greg Smith, and I live in Morrow County.
Okay.
What I'm going to propose, I openly admit, I'm swimming upstream in a swift current.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. I work for the Port of Morrow in Boardman, and we're a countywide port authority that's charged with economic development in Morrow County and all of Eastern Oregon. And in the city of Boardman, we have an enterprise zone that we use to attract industry. It's a tool that's been very successful for us. And we want to continue to utilize that tool. Unfortunately, a community in our county, 50 miles to the south of us, has experienced a recent mill closure in which over 135 family wage jobs have been lost. And what the Port of Morro would like to see happen is a conceptual amendment to House Bill 2247 that would allow us to change the distance of an enterprise zone from 25 miles to 50 miles. We believe this makes, if for no other reason, administrative sense, and that we don't want to create additional zones. We just want to have the opportunity to take our current zone and move it down to one of the communities that have the need. We think this is an issue that doesn't affect only Morro County, but it affects all of rural eastern Oregon, and we think this makes sense. I apologize coming before you at the last minute. I know that's unfair to you, but this is an issue that means a lot to the community of Heppner, and we wanted to at least give it a try.
What kind of question to Greg Smith?
Mr.
Senator Fisher.
Well, you say extended from 25 miles to 50 miles. When it says extended, can they be two separate areas considered as one? They don't have to have the area between the fences on the road right away, all the way between them in order to...
Senator, that's exactly what we're trying to get at. Rather than having multiple zones with multiple managers, multiple committees, we think it makes sense in rural eastern Oregon to have one committee, one manager, who oversees the zone that benefits those multiple areas. For example, we have a zone in Boardman, and what we would like to do is literally draw a line down to the industrial park in Heppner and extend that zone. It's the same committee that oversees it. The city supports that, and the county supports that.
Which county and which city?
The cities of Boardman and Heppner and the county of Morro.
Okay, do you have your thoughts with all the cities and county folks?
Yeah, Senator Nelson's office has made contact with representatives from the cities and the counties, and we've heard no negative comments. What's attractive, we think about our idea, is it leaves it still at the discretion of the cities and counties. It says may be extended. And so if the city or county chose not to extend it, they wouldn't have to, but for rural eastern Oregon, where our communities are separated so far by distance, it makes sense for us.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, and thank you very much. Would you please stand by? I'd like to call the Mike and Art. Before you move on to the issue, could you address the particular issue from 25 miles to 50 miles zone session?
Senator Lim, members of the committee. Yes, in 1997, the legislature changed the distances that were allowed in zones from no more than 5 miles between separate parts and no more than 12 miles overall, to no more than 15 miles between separate parts and no more than 25 miles overall. These distances have helped a large number of areas to combine together with their more proximate neighbors to form common enterprise zones. And we have several enterprise zones that involve multiple cities and a county. And right now we have applications from several in which two, three, or even up to four cities are involved, and this has worked out very well. We feel that the 25 miles is a good conservative distance. It brings up areas throughout Wallowa County, all the cities in Mountaineer County and Sherman County. So it's a good distance for eastern Oregon, in which we had intended it to work. With the bill as it's been adopted by the House, our solution for some additional areas that want enterprise zone designations is to allow for some additional non-urban enterprise zones to exist in the future so that closer groups of communities, in this case, the cities of Heppner, Lexington, and Ione, which are a great distance away from the recent Columbia River enterprise zone, which comprises Boardman and Morro County in the north, those three cities in the south could go for their own enterprise zone at some point, and actually they have actually such a county specific application has been received from them for this current round of applications in which we have Grant County, Sherman County, and others applying with a collection of cities involved.
Okay. Would you like to add some comments? Let's see. Mike.
Yes. Chairman Lynn, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify today. I'm Mike Burton, Assistant Director of the Economic Development Department. We've been here a number of times and have already commented on the bill. We urge you to consider the bill favorably and pass it out as it stands.
Okay.
We're happy to answer questions.
How about the 6 miles that the proposal program?
I would have the same comments as Art does.
Okay. Any questions from the members? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any other person like to testify on House Bill 2247? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2247. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2247. We heard that there's testimony in a case from the gentleman in Greg and extend from 25 to 50 miles, and what is the choice of the members of the committee? Yes, Senator Cochran.
Well, Mr. Chair, apparently the OEDD folks weren't real crazy about the amendment, but I wondered if it would be possible to, since there was a conceptual amendment that the gentleman was suggesting anyway, and we can't deal with those, that we give them, I realize time is of the essence, but that we give them, since we're going to meet again on Thursday, at least till Thursday to see if OEDD can meet with Mr. Smith and try to construct something that might assist them with their economic development. I personally am not crazy about enterprise zones. I'll support them because we need, you know, Senator Beyer really wants them to support it. I'll support them. I'm yet to be convinced of the actual family wage that has to get created out of them. But having said that, if we want to try to help these folks out and they're asking for help, then why don't we do that by giving them 2 days to come up with some sort of compromise? Okay.
I would support that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Likewise.
Okay. The House bill, we have up to the May 15th.
Up this year?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
we're going to be here August next year.
Next year.
Okay. I don't know what the hurry is.
Okay. At least the Senate bill has to move out by the end of this week. The House bill, we still have a little more time. Am I correct?
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
Okay. I like to be correct sometimes.
All the time.
All the time. Okay. Since we have one concern raised, I think it's prudent to take a little more time to work it out, hopefully. So with that, and I'm going to close the public work session House 2047.
If I may, I called, and there is a subsequent referral on 2092.
Which one?
The one that we just voted out.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So you want to have a tip?
We need to suspend the rules.
I think that
bring the bill back.
You read there. Thing, and so I called to make sure before our meeting was over.
Okay.
So
what's the language we need to...
I guess we need to open work session again.
Yeah, okay.
And suspend the rules under which we passed the bill and then reconsider the bill and then move it.
Did I close the 2247?
Can you do it?
Yeah. Did I close the 2047?
Yes.
Okay. I'm unsure if Carol is... Don't we own the bill for a certain amount of time? 3 days,
yes.
So we may not have to do a reconsideration. We may just be able to make a motion.
I have to call for someone to come down here and try to give us some direction, so we had to wait for a few minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes. Okay. And so I closed the public hearing on this one. And
it's an Irish logo.
Oh,
I think
nice.
An important enough reason right there.
I like it.
Now, if they had an English Jack on there, I would have said no way.
Okay. Can we go to the next one here?
We can, sorry. We can take any order you want.
Okay. Senator Ferrioli here? Okay, I don't see him here.
He's the short Irish guy.
Okay.
Irish.
Oh.
Very sapphires.
Okay, unless it's something mind really. I'd like to open a public hearing at Senate Bill 947. Let me see, we have done this one, but we have done this one.
What are we doing?
Okay. Is any person like to testify on that the Senate Bill 947? Okay, I guess no one. We heard this bill before. Since I don't see anyone here, let's see, I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 947, and I'm going to open a work session, Senate Bill 947. So why don't you explain what this 947 does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 947 is a bill which prohibits the Oregon State Lottery from doing any promotional type advertising of lottery games. It does allow limited advertising for new games to introduce them for a specified period of time. There are no amendments that are being proposed for this memo, for this bill.
Okay.
There is a revenue impact and a fiscal impact statement. Both have been issued. The estimated revenue impact to Senate Bill 947 would be a reduction of lottery transfers to the Economic Development Fund in the approximate amount of $19 million each year. This is based on the reduction of games sold for the for the reduced advertising.
Okay, what's the blank should be there?
Whatever number of days you choose.
Okay.
You... 30 days.
Okay. Okay. This is the, as you heard, the Senate Bill 947 concerning the lottery's advertisement. Did you say $90 million in biennium?
Yes.
Mostly it is the video poker game, which is about 75% of total revenue. We don't, that's not allowed to advertise, but only the traditional games such as scratch game and plus others that they spend about $19 million. Mm-hmm. This will stop the advertisement of this lottery in our state. I think we need to fill up here that's section two, that's the line 16, and section 2,
section
2A
is down. Mr. Chair, basically, the bill first just defines what advertising is in section 2, and then it goes on and says that this prohibition of advertising does not apply in three instances, and they're numbers A, B, and C. The first one says that new lottery games which are introduced after this date may continue to be advertised, but for no longer than a designated number of days, which the committee may determine how many days they feel is appropriate. Section B says that...
talking about the new games?
Yes, a new lottery games.
Okay.
Advertising for the purpose of introducing a new game to the public.
Okay.
Is permitted for a designated number of days.
Okay.
It goes on and makes a second exception to the prohibition, and that is just dissemination of purely informational material about a new game.
Okay.
Such as the rules of the game, how it is to be played, how much money can be won while playing the game, that sort of thing. And finally, the posting of decals on the location of a place where lottery games are available for sale. Those are the three exceptions to the advertising prohibition under Senate Bill 947.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran.
I think the committee staff's Freudian slip on the destination of information was done because she spent too much time around you.
Okay. She's trying to help me out.
It was Friday.
For me, I think it's that, at least 3 months, in case it's 90 days might be upset rate, 30 days might not be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to call the Chris and want to give us some wisdom in case if there is any new games, what's the appropriate date at least to reasonable that the information of advertising.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Chris Lyons. I'm the director of the Oregon Lottery. Could you repeat your question for me one more time?
In the bill, section 2, line 16, I would read the section, subsection 2 and A. The advertisement of a new lottery game introduced after effective date of this 1999 Act. However, advertisement authorized by this paragraph may not continue for longer than how many days after the introduction of the new lottery game?
Mr. Chairman, could I ask for clarification? Are you speaking of like an individual scratch ticket? Are you speaking of that as a new game, or are you thinking about a new game like a new Powerball game or a new game that we might produce?
Other than the video poker game, I consider it a new game.
So you're saying all of our games except for video poker, we don't
have to. Yes, the traditional game I'm talking about.
On our individual scratch tickets, we introduce about 36 scratch tickets each year, and we probably here in terms of media 6 to 8 of those. And then on those 36 games, we put out point of sale material and banners and posters into the businesses. Are you wanting to include that printed material in your definition of advertising too?
I think it has an exception. What is the interpretation for that?
Advertising is defined in Section 2 as any act or process, any broadcast communication, medium, or printed communication, including outdoor advertising signs, that call public attention to the Oregon State Lottery for the purpose of enticing, urging, or persuading individuals to buy shares or tickets in lottery games.
I would, based on that definition, sir, suggest that you would need to have materials up on new games for at least 60 days.
60 days.
And that would include the posters in the stores.
Okay.
And
so could we say not more than 90 days will sufficient?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate
it. Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Does that modify the figures that have been given us as far as reductions and amounts put back into from the lack of advertising?
No, sir, it does not.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
How long do you normally advertise?
We advertise our products on an ongoing basis. Powerball, Megabucks, those we run campaigns on those periodically during the year. On our scratch tickets, we run promotions. We advertise those on a constant basis. We do recycle the point of sale materials, but I think the premise of us not being able to advertise our product freely and keep the product in front of the player will in fact continue to erode the revenue that we're able to generate from the auction.
Mr. Chair, following.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
I understood you correctly. Some of this material goes out to the individual stores or the individual retailers. What are they in any particular danger, or will they be fined or otherwise disciplined if they forget to get certain advertising down by a certain deadline? Or
so, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I really, we don't, of course, have any of those kinds of restrictions currently, and I really haven't thought that through. I think we have a violation of law here if this, these materials remain under our contract with our retailers. I'm sort of thinking off the top of my head, we have penalties for violation of law, and there are disciplinary procedures in those, in our master contract, so conceivably there would be penalties associated with not taking down advertising, but I really haven't thought any of that through. But I think potentially we'd have, from a technical perspective, a violation of law here that could impact the retailer's contract. We have progressive disciplines associated with that in our contract. But there would be some potential discipline here, I think.
Mr. Chair, this just seems to me to be something that hasn't been very well thought out or very well figured out on how operations are doing. It seems to be more knowledge about what the money's going to be and not be, rather than how it's going to affect the retailer and what they're all going to have to put up with. And, frankly, I'm not interested in causing our retailers any more hassle if you've got 15 games or 10-5 games or something like that. You've got to try to remember what's been up for 90 days, or when 90 days comes from a certain date, or go around and keep checking things and forget to do something Monday morning when you were closed for the holiday or something. I just don't...
Like the idea. Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, this stimulated an additional concern that may need a clarification in the record, in that our traditional products, our retailers may in fact advertise those on their own and not just put up advertising materials provided by the Oregon Lottery, and I was frankly focusing on materials provided by the Oregon Lottery. There may be additional issues here through potential through this bill about advertising that our retailers might want to do, and constitutional issues in terms of free speech and what we can or cannot require our retailers to do with regard to advertising.
What kind of a retailer said what customer
is that? A retailer might put up a sign in their store that they've made themselves that says Powerball, today's jackpot, $45 million. They may put something in the newspaper associated with a particular product that we sell. They might say, buy scratch tickets here or something like that. And I was frankly just focusing on the lottery piece and had not thought through issues associated with individual advertising that our retailers might do. And that if you do at some point move this bill, you may want to create some additional clarification.
Actually, current retailers, they do advertise in the newspaper and the radio, any other than state?
Currently, there's no prohibition, and we have retailers that do advertise our product, albeit on a limited basis. Most of the advertising is in the store itself in terms of promoting products, but they have the latitude to advertise the traditional
okay. But actually, do the retailers, do they advertise in the radio or newspaper or any other TV. Actually, are they doing any advertising?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Hooper, Public Affairs Manager. I apologize. I was had to be in Senate revenue.
No problem.
Mr. Chairman, our retailers, some of our retailers do in fact advertise lottery products as part of their overall advertising for their business. Many of them include the lottery logo, all lottery games sold here at the bottom of the newspaper ad. I have seen retailers do the same thing on TV, come in, get our two-for-one steak special. We've got this great thing going. Come here to the stand, and while you're here, you can enjoy all lottery games. So I think that the issue raised by Senator Fisher, Director Lyons, that initially we were just focusing on what the lottery does, but this legislation as written would indeed also impact what retailers do on their own.
Okay. To me, that, yeah, that's information and advertisement is okay. Only what we're talking about, the promotional advertisement, this is a good thing. You know, this will make you rich sometime. You know, some kind of a promotional. I have a lot of calls from people. They are set up some kind of a advertisement. It will make them rich someday when they do that. And, hopefully.
Mr. Chair, that's, the other day in a pharmacy here in Salem, I saw an ad for lottery tickets that said, save the schools. And I was actually pretty offended, you know, on one level. On the other level, even though the U.S., the Oregon Constitution prohibits me from agreeing with Senator Fisher more than once in an afternoon, and we've already agreed on the first bill today, I have to agree with him. You know, it's the same discussion we had before. You can't go after the lottery until you figure out which, where you're going to get the revenue to support the programs that the lottery supports. And this just weakens the lottery without doing anything about the funds that we would lose because of the lottery. We've had this discussion, Mr. Chair. I agree with you. We shouldn't be using lottery money for education, but we are, and we're in a very big crisis in terms of funding it. So I can't support the bill because of that reason.
Thank you. My concerns, I think that the, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm going to, we'll respond there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to close.
Mr. Chair, before you close?
Yes.
There are just a couple of clarifications I would like to get
okay.
on the measure, and Carol, you can help me out with this. The last time we looked at an LFO statement, it was back on April 7th when we first heard the bill, and I want to just make sure that the numbers we looked at that time are still accurate, so that as we look at the possible loss to the Economic Development Fund, that would be how much in 99-01 and 01-03.
Are you talking about revenue?
Revenue.
The revenue statement that we had issued on April 6th, since it gives a broad interpretation, it doesn't break it down, stating that the transfer to the fund is $19 million per year, not biennium.
Advertising.
The revenue that would be lost because of the reduction in advertising would be $19 million per year
to the economic.
Not by any means, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. To the Economic Development Fund.
Yes.
And then to the State School Fund.
Well, that would be broken down. That's the total amount. Then it would be broken down to the stipend.
Okay.
And they didn't break down the numbers to each section.
I see.
15% out.
So the State School Fund is incorporated
yes.
in that. All right.
Mm-hmm. No, excuse me. It says Economic Development Fund. I apologize.
Okay.
It's revenue does say Economic Development
Fund. Right, and I don't have that right in front of me, so I'm counting on
it.
Go ahead. Just continue. What I'm trying to establish here are what the potential losses would be to those two funds as best we know it, given the research that has been provided by residents.
I'm sorry, Senator. I don't understand.
Okay, let me back up again.
Since we still under the public hearing, at least I'd like to give the opportunity to the people and presentation, like I said, by then.
Mm-hmm.
After that, then we will discuss our own. If that sounds fair, or you need to know that answer by now.
I would like at some point before we conclude today, get the most current figures on what the impact would be to those two funds. And what's behind my question, Mr. Chair, is pretty much the same question that Senator Corcoran raises, which is the loss of revenue, and then I want, as a legislator representing my constituents who are asking me, where's the replacement revenue, I want to be able to talk about that piece as well, and right now I can't. And then I also would want to know, because there's been some mention of what this might ultimately cost in terms of jobs to small businesses who also rely on the advertising dollars, what the impact would be there. We're the Trade and Economic Development Committee, and so if we're going to take an action that's going to have an impact on small businesses, increase, decrease, or something else, I would like to know what that impact is. So I thank you for bearing with me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Chair, I would like to testify on the Senate Bill 947. Okay. Since I don't hear anybody, I'm going to close the public hearing Senate Bill 947, and then I'll wait the member. Okay, I'm going to open a work session of Senate Bill 947. Yes, Senator Fisher.
Your wording in Section 2 on page 1, lines 7 through 12, are pretty explicit. Just flat out that the director of the Oregon State Lottery shall not authorize or allow advertising or promotion of lottery games. Using this subsection, advertising means any act or process in any broadcast communications medium or printed communications medium, including outdoor advertising signs that calls public attention to the Oregon State Lottery for the purpose of enticing, urging, or persuading individuals to buy shares or tickets in lottery games or otherwise participate in lottery games.
Okay.
If anybody did that on TV or anything like that, they'd be violating this any way you cut it. And I guess I'm not really as worried about income and replacement income as I'm worried about what this does to business people involved in this process. And having to keep a whole bunch more rules and regulations in mind, that's just all small business needs right now is a whole bunch of other new rules and regulations and stuff that they've got to clean off their boards and shelves by certain dates and stuff like that.
Okay.
So,
thank you. Yeah. My concern is we are talking about the revenue loss. But who is going to replace the loss of the people? That's my concern. It's not the rich people who are paying the fines to the city. It's that the people, that the average and low-income people, last dollar they have, instead of buying the milk, they are buying the scratch, while their children are hungry. We are just looking at the number up front, but the social cost associated with it is 2-3 times bigger. I think the state government, and that they're dancing enough with devil and try to cut the deal with the devil. And I think it's about time that we, with a conscience, that we stand up what is right for the state, for the people. Do we need more money from gambling to educate our children? And then right now, in the national, we are talking about the tobacco issue. We just cut the advertisement because it's harmful to the people. And that this gambling interesting to the people's mind from early on, and as they grow up, we got a problem in our state, and what around 100,000 people in our state already pathological gamblers, even more so. You know. So I think somewhere, someplace, that we have to teach our children the value of the hard work, not just depending on opportunistic that they get rich in the future. It's not going to work. You know, if someone has a lot of money, play, it gamble is fine. But the cost of our state and the country is getting bigger and bigger on this issue. I think it's about time we send a strong message to people. That's our concern.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I'm with you in sending a strong message to people. I've always said I didn't vote for the lottery. I wouldn't vote for it again. I'd support you now if you had a bill to get rid of it. But I'm sick and tired of taking it out on our little business people. Others, that doesn't stop the problem. And the Supreme Court seems to have ideas about what rich people can do in comparison to what poor people can do and vice versa. And from that standpoint, the only way to deal with this, if you don't like what it does to the small people and the poor people, is to get rid of it completely. And that I wouldn't argue with you, and I don't argue what is happening out there. I have some beliefs right along those lines myself.
Well,
yet I just I get downright tired of just making our small business people in general, the targets of things that they have to just remember, just making their business more and more problematic and more complicated for them. And that's all this does. It doesn't stop one single thing. It doesn't say that a poor person can't come in and do it. It's just, and who's to say that a poor person is going to be any more susceptible to advertising than a rich person is?
Senator, that's just my argument is, if you want a small people, this is the way we need to have a small people. When they buy, people buy first tickets, $1 buy, they get 5 cents. When they buy milk or any other product from the can of soup from the grocery store, it helps them, not hurting them at all. So the gambling money takes away the business from the small people. You ask them, I know. Because I met them, I talked to them, I used to do the work for myself. When I talk to them, this gambling money takes away their business. You know, this is the way we need to help them out.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I appreciate your passion about this, but, you know, I have to say that if you were that passionate about helping out the small people, then possibly what you might want to redirect your energy towards is getting us to tax equity in this state before we start dealing with how we get rid of some of our social ills. Because, I mean, we live off other sin taxes as well, on drugs and, you know, on cigarettes and alcohol. And we finance cigarette cessation programs through a sin tax on cigarettes, you know. So, I mean, we do a lot of ludicrous things in terms of our tax policy, but, you know, you talk about teaching children the value of hard work and the value of education. You know, nowhere could you do that more in teaching kids about the fairness that rich people don't rule in this society. And just because they're able to get, you know, their candidates elected here, they get favorable tax policies and the poor get nothing. So, you know, if you could expand the discussion a little broader, you'd get more support. But in terms of the gambling thing, you're trying to fix one thing while we have this whole systemic problem, you know, that's staring us right in the face in terms of juvenile crime prevention and adequate education for kids. And until we get at the more fundamental question of tax equity, I don't think you're going to accomplish, even though I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish, and I appreciate that there are a lot of poor victims in, you know, gambling's not only God's way of telling you you're bad at math, but that you got too much money, you know. That's, people are going to gamble, and we need to look at some bigger social problems as well.
Well, with that, yes.
So we have this one. I want to share to explain the fiscal analysis.
Please,
the infection has come from medical assistance.
Okay, let me discuss a little bit more, and then let's do that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I agree that, yes, there are social costs. I think that we're all very aware of those and feel your sense of urgency about that. I know I certainly do. And I would also agree that this is a debate that we should have on the floor of the House and Senate. And toward that end, you know, I'm willing to provide a courtesy vote when we get to that point to move the bill, hopefully move the bill toward that debate. But I will not be one who supports the bill itself on the floor of the Senate. For these reasons, I think it's our responsibility as legislators to also have a plan for how we would transition away from using the dollars as we now spend them. And we don't have a plan. And so that's the piece that's really troubling to me. I really hear what you're saying about the social costs and the many lives that have been and are being destroyed because of this monster that we created. I mean, we did this, and we're paying that price. But I think it is our responsibility to also have a plan for that day, that time, when we transition away from the lottery. And we don't have that, and a part of the discussion and debate we need to be having is what Senator Corcoran has suggested, which is, you know, long-term revenue solution that gets us to paying for those things that Oregonians value, like K-12 education, higher education, Head Start, and anything else that each of us might put on that list. But in the absence of a plan, I'm troubled about the
I really respect the opinions of the each, and which is entitled, but I appreciate that that is giving a courtesy. I think this bill has a merit as a full discussion at the Senate floor. I think it's about time to discuss the issue up and down. Each individual, if this goes to the floor, each individual has to decide on their own at that point. Before we go on, I'd like to find out what the fiscal impact on these issues. I'd like to call Adrian. Adrian Sexton, will you please come up? We appreciate your time.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Adrian Sexton, fiscal analyst with the Legislative Fiscal Office, and I'm here to answer any questions that you have on the impact statement that was issued to the committee on April 7th.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, would you like
to go to this?
Ms. Sexton, trying to understand what the loss would be to the Economic Development Fund and also to the State School Fund in total dollars.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the description that I have under effect on expenditures are relative to lottery funds, and the information from the Lottery Commission is described on page 2 as their estimate of revenue reductions would be in the range of $12 to $23 million in the first biennium. That would be 9901. And since that would be a partial biennium, it could go as high as $35 million in the full 2001-03 biennium. To estimate the impact to the Economic Development Fund as a whole, I'll back up just a trifle. As you're probably aware, the Lottery Commission distributes to the Department of Administrative Services after it takes administrative costs the residue of the lottery proceeds to DAS, which then distributes it to the Economic Development Fund, but there are some fixed expenses in there that are the 15% to Measure 66 appropriations, the 15% to the Education Endowment Fund, and there's some other elements that receive lottery dollars off the top. Debt service infrastructure bonds and other lottery bonds, debt service. The residue then is available to look at in the budget, the governor's recommended budget for the 1999-01 biennium, allocates portions out to the state school fund, and that total in his recommended budget at this time is $295 million. There is a portion that's set aside for a variety of economic development fund activities. And then there is a portion which is set aside for gambling addiction treatment. When I've had measures before me for doing fiscal impact statements on lottery proceeds that have been dedicating, allocating another portion of the lottery proceeds to a specific program, I have routinely demonstrated the shift of that lottery money from the set-aside that the governor has recommended in his current budget proposal on a pro rata basis on the totals that he has set aside, simply to show that when you move the allocation from one place to another, there is going to be a reduction. That reduction, for purposes of example, is pro rata out for those three areas. In this case, the commission has estimated that because of the advertising restriction, that there would be revenue reductions. Those reductions, I placed it somewhere towards the high end of the range that they provided me, and the pro rata deductions then, or reductions that would occur on that basis to the state school fund would be $18.6 million and so forth. That doesn't mean that that's where it would have to be taken, but merely that there would be some reduction taken somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you talking about the deduction from the video poker and then that the traditional game all combined together?
Mr. Chair, there are some distinctive allocations from the proceeds of video lottery. And perhaps someone from the commission can help me out on that. If the bill applies to all advertising of lottery games, then presumably the reduction in revenues would also occur for any kind of lottery game.
What do you mean, all advertisements? The video poker and whole thing you're talking about? Video poker, traditional game, you're talking about the whole advertisement?
The limit, Mr. Chair, the limitation of advertising in the measure, if the lottery game's advertising applies to video poker as well, it does not, I stand corrected, then I would assume that the commission has given me information on the lottery, traditional lottery thing.
Video poker, which is close to 80% of video poker game, total revenue, they don't need advertisement. Only we are talking about a small portion of that the traditional game, they spend about $10 million advertisement for that portion only. It has nothing to do with the poker game, what we are talking about here.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can help. For the record, this line is lottery director. When lottery revenues are calculated and sent over to the Department of Administrative Services on a quarterly basis, there really is a distinction between lottery revenues and video poker revenues. The entire lump sum of money it goes over. And so when the budgets are built, although there is a little piece of video proceeds that are pulled off for a specific purpose with the counties, when the governor has taken the projected lottery revenues and built budgets, it's really built on total lottery dollars. And so when we're speaking about reductions to the governor's budget and money available, we're really talking about that. I think we talked about $19 million. There's a range of between $12 and $23 million here. The pro rata reductions are really pulling off a percent from the endowment and percent from all of these various sources in terms of how the money is distributed. So when you think about the dollar reduction, you really can't separate video and traditional.
Yes.
It's just a dollar reduction.
Okay. But this that advertising amount only coming from the traditional games,
right,
from the video poker at all.
Right, but yeah, if there's less traditional money, then video poker money is going to be used for some of those programs.
Yeah.
The whole pot is going to be reduced by that dollar amount.
Okay. It's a clear for us. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yes, Senator Duncan.
Is there a referral to Wilson Means at all?
Oh, no, this is the revenue, not the Ways and Means.
Right, but yeah, it certainly has an impact on Ways and Means.
It has to go to revenue, doesn't it?
Pardon?
There is no subsequent referral, Mr. Chair.
No subsequent referral.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I have a further question. I would guess that probably you bought some billboard space in your political advertisements. Have you ever dealt with the billboard people?
Me?
In your political advertising?
Yes, I
do. They go by a month. And lots of times, if they don't have anything coming up in the month afterward, a sign will stay up.
Yes, personally, I didn't have any billboards, but the others do. Yeah.
But, and they don't go out and strip the billboard. They wait until they have something to put on it, and there's no limit to them for 90 days. Not only that, and it says here, authorize or allow advertising for the 90 days after the introduction of the new lottery game. If they didn't introduce it on the exact day of the first of the month, or the day of the month that the billboards were posted for the coming month, they would either lose money or have to have it stripped down early. It would be a terrible thing, as far as I can see, to try to monitor what you were doing. And if the sign company didn't, there's no provision in here, if the sign company didn't get it taken down and it lasted for 3 or 4 months afterwards up there because somebody didn't purchase the billboard, how do you deal with those things under this? I mean, are they going to have to go out there with their own ladder and strip that stuff off of their fingernails or something, or,
yeah,
or paint it over? You know, these are...
That's on page 3 of the bill.
These are...
as long as we don't pay for it, you know. As long as the dollar doesn't go
it. Well, it would be paid for because if you did the 3 months or the 90 days, it could extend past.
Okay.
Authorize or allow advertising after certain dates. So.
Okay. With that, did I open the work session? Yes, I did. I think I opened the work session. So I'd like to propose or mention that we add that the page 1, line 16, and that we have not more than 90 days. So they can go up to the 90 days for advertisement according to the administrator or director of this. The 60 days will be enough, but I'm just giving 90 days. That might be more than sufficient enough. So any objection or other thing that is the conceptual amendment, not more than 90 days to fill in the blank? There's no objection to adopt. Okay. Let's move this bill to the floor, the Senate Bill 947 to the floor with a two pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I really believe we need to do a process check on this one. I know that you are wanting to move this today, but I believe we need some clarity on whether this goes to Ways and Means or not. For the sake of our process being consistent and thinking about actions that have been taken in other committees, like our Senate Education Committee, where a similar issue has come up at least three times, this may need to go to Ways and Means. So if there's a way to get that process check, that question,
answer quickly, we'll know what to do next.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Gordy, are you asking me to find out a serious
question? I'm asking through the chair. I am doing that.
What I'm doing is leading the process at this point, and they looked at the deal. Mm-hmm. There's no deferral at all. And what I assure you, when it has out, I will check with the extension office. Mm-hmm. If they believe it goes to ways and means or revenue department, will bring it back and do so. Apparently, I trust what they have done up to this point. There has been a deferral, and for that I'm going to wait.
However, Mr. Chair, the committee may recommend that it be referred to ways and means.
I don't want that. You know, this is deserved to the water flow, and it has to be discussed there. And if at the flow, if they want to send the ways and means, and then revenue, that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just a parliamentary inquiry. Can the chair move a motion to move the bill to the floor?
I guess I haven't seen anything.
Senator Duncan says you can.
I think so.
Yes. I think anyone can do that.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Not usual, but in.
Okay. Well, if then if someone else likes to move, it's fine with me. Okay. If not, let's see. Any other discussion? I think we have a live discussion and the people here, and then we're going to need to know. I believe in fair process. We heard this bill last session many times, and this session, it is not my intention just to throw you something, but that time is limited for us to look at the many bills. This week, is the Senate bill is the last time we can look at it. So let's discuss it at the floor and let's see what happens.
Okay.
You know, I believe the process. I believe the wisdom of the senators, of the people. I think we will do the right thing. With that, would you please call the roll?
Are you making a motion, Senator Lynn?
Yes, I did.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mr.
Yes.
Chair, may I make a comment?
Sure.
Okay, I will, as a courtesy to the chair, I will vote for the floor, but I should have noticed that I will vote against the bill on the floor.
That's perfectly fine. At least I appreciate your courtesy to the vote. That's what I'm asking for at this point. Please call the roll.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll do likewise. Just the courtesy.
I already know
absolutely
that.
Will not vote for this bill.
I already know that.
So don't have me carry it.
Okay. Okay, close the roll, please.
Senator Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
No.
Aye. Aye. The Senate Bill 947 passed, and Senator Sofran, you like to carry?
No. I know that it's against procedure, the Senate rules, Mr. Chair, to be the carrier of a bill.
It seems to me that I'm the only one that has to carry this
would
one.
Die before
okay.
We even got to the
floor. Okay, Chair will carry the Senate Bill.
This would be like a
947, but for the record, I just want to thank each member for that out of the courtesy supporting this bill, but if each member up to your conscience to vote for the bill.
Let's go first and go in courtesy.
I just wanted to record, and no discourtesy to you, but it's been my position since I've been in the legislature to vote no in committee if I'm going to vote no on the floor, and I stick by that, and I don't have any discourtesy to you in the process.
So be it. If it's my only lone vote in the Senate, so be it.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
If I may refer back to House Bill 2092 with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, I have been advised that because that subsequent referral is already on record from the Senate President's office, that is what will happen. And the motion and vote that the committee took is perfectly appropriate. However, if the committee wishes to recommend that referral be rescinded, then you may wish to rescind your vote and make a new motion and vote again.
I think we will be better on a safe side.
Okay.
Rescind the motion and then return to the awaiting meeting.
So you want to leave it as it is?
No, no, I want to rescind it.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
What?
I think we need to bring back to the committee again and for reconsideration. So how do we do
that? Right now, this bill will automatically go to Ways and Means. Vote that you took
that will do it.
Is adequate to do that, yes.
Okay, without referring to.
Without referring
okay.
to, yes.
So is that looks all right?
That's fine.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So we're done with
2092. Oh,
2092.
Yeah, 2092. Change directions on your time. Oh,
you're the
carrier. Did I close 942?
Yes. 947?
947.
Do it again.
Okay, I'd like to close work session 947. So make sure it's closed. And so are you sure usually at the committee meeting that we are when we do that, that we rescinded and we sent to Ways and
Means? When the referral has already been made by the Senate President's office, that has nothing to do with your committee action. That will happen unless you recommend the rescission of that referral.
Okay.
And since you did not do
that, I want to make sure. Okay.
Well, we don't want to pick fight Senator Adams. He's got enough on his plate right now, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
He can't even find his budget yet.
Okay. And with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on the, which one is it? The court. Okay. I'd like to open a public hearing, Senate Bill 1307. Who are the list of, like, set five? A lot of people. Which is the first one? Is this one for? Okay. I'd like to call at this time. What's the name? Here.
Fletcher.
Yes,
Urban.
Come on over.
Fine, Irish lad.
Are you alone, or you like to come with someone else? You're bringing a beautiful lady with you.
Yes.
Okay. And your name Diane Perry. And the CRTC. What's the CRTC mean?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Diane Perry, and I represent the Columbia River Channel Coalition.
Okay. And Herb, we all know you, and you're from the Oregon.
AFL-CIO.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, welcome.
The facts and figures person here is the Sister Perry.
Okay.
We would simply like to put on the record that we reluctantly oppose the bill. We are a member, if you read Sister Perry's handout, of the Columbia River Channel Coalition, the Oregon AFL-CIO, along with the Washington State Labor Council, which can't be here, and my compatriot up there has allowed me to use his name and his organization also reluctantly in opposition to 1307.
Okay.
Sister Perry will furnish you with the facts and the long history of our coalition to deepen the channels of
policy. It is my, that since the time is the essence, even though we like to give you as much time as you want to, I think the time is limited. And if you give us the vitally important points, we'd appreciate there about the, let me see, about the 15 people like to testify.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I feel a bit guilty on this because, we talked about this on Friday.
Yeah.
And at that time I said I was going to move to table this.
Yeah.
And my understanding is many of the people who were opposed to it, from that story and so forth, are not here. Do we have people who are in opposition? I mean, who are in opposition to other than them too? Because
let me see. Some people, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 against, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to be sure that it was representative because I know a lot of people didn't come down because they assumed that would happen. And
okay.
That's true.
Yes.
I want to reiterate that. I had discussed with Senator Duke, and she said that
members of her own district, she informed them this weekend that the bill was to be tabled, and therefore they are not here to testify, and that her own folks from the Astoria area feel that they're not ready for this yet, and if they were ready for some sort of study group, it would be something that they would like to construct themselves rather than have it come from the governor's appointments and doing a broad-based study. So I feel like I should relay that bit of information as well, and I would have supported the motion to table it. And you told me on the floor today that you'd like to have some public discussion. So public discussion aside, I mean, I have to leave for Natural Resource Committee right now, but public hearing aside, I'll support the table motion.
Okay. Good. You can do that when you have a work session.
Right.
This is only today is only public hearing.
Okay.
And so I think we have a duty to hear from people.
Sure.
And if we shut out the process, I think we got a bigger problem. We need to have a fair process, open process, either one way or another. So that's why I think it was too late to notify some people. So they are here. I think we are obliged to hear.
You're not going into work session today?
I don't think we are at this point.
Okay. I wasn't planning to be here beyond 4:30, so I'll stay for a little while.
I do appreciate it.
Work session.
Yes. Okay. Okay. That was our own discussion. Please pardon us. And please, Diane, go ahead.
Thanks very much. Again, for the record, I'm Diane Terry, representing the Columbia River Channel Coalition. I just wanted to cover a couple of quick points. The group that I represent was founded by the seven ports who are the sponsors of the channel study, and that includes the ports of Astoria, St. Helens in Portland, Oregon, Coloma, Longview, Vancouver, and Woodland, Washington. In addition to founding the organization of ports, I've then worked to build support, and in the testimony that I've submitted to the committee, there's a list of supporters from both Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana who are supporting this project. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Just real quickly, in addition, we also have a leadership advisory group chaired by former Senator Mark Hatfield, and there's about 40 people from the region that serve on that, representing business and labor and maritime and grain groups, including Mr. Fletcher, Brother Fletcher.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Real quickly, there were three points that I wanted to cover. First of all, that about 10 years' worth of studies already gone into the Channel Deepening Project. Millions of dollars have been invested in that, and there's a tremendous amount of work that's gone on to build support for the project. That's, as a representative of the ports, that's been my job. I'm a liaison to communities, to people concerned, to different interests that are concerned about the project so that we can make it the best possible project when we get to the end, rather than getting to the end and having lots of opposition. Where we are in the process is that we expect that the final feasibility study will be issued this year. On a preliminary basis, the finding was that $38.7 million in annual transportation cost savings have been identified. There's an attachment of the chart that I attached to your material. This chart right here shows you by commodity, by wheat, by corn, and by containers, the transportation cost savings that are anticipated. Fundamentally, just because the ships are larger, they can carry more product, and it's a transportation efficiency issue. The other main point that I wanted to make, in addition to the fact that lots of study has gone into this and that it means a tremendous amount to the regional economy, and it's not just Oregon and Washington, it's Idaho, Montana, and states east. The other point that I wanted to make real briefly is that what we're talking about from a national standpoint, when you get beyond the region, looking at it from a national on a national basis, we are the second largest grain shipping area in the world, and we are the largest wheat shipping area in the world. So it's of significant importance to the growers and to a variety of people across the region. And then finally, where we are in terms of the schedule is that from the standpoint of pursuing a study or doing additional study on this project at this point in time, the people that have been supporting this for a very long time would like to see it move forward. Not to say that the state might not want to study other things. We certainly wouldn't want to see the Channel Deepening study delayed. The time is now. We already have ships calling on the river. that can carry more product, and because of the navigation restrictions, you know, the depth limit at 40 feet, it can't carry any more than that. And so with that, I realize time is of the essence, and you've got other speakers, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you all have.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wardley.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to be here this afternoon. Again, for the record, the feasibility study and report are due in June. Is that still the timeline?
That's what we anticipate, that we'll have a final EIS out for review in June.
And the public review that's scheduled for that time, can you comment on what that public review format, what that might look like?
From what I know right now, that will be a reissuance of the document. What's happened is in October of last year, Corps of Engineers issued the draft EIS, and then they went out and held a series of public meetings. One was in Astoria, one was in Portland, one was in Longview. They took public comment. The public comment period was extended until February 5th of this year. There have been, I've seen the stack of comment letters. It's about this high. They're now developing responses to all of that. The draft EIS will be revised in response to the comments, and it will go out again for public review. I believe that at least one public meeting is scheduled in Astoria. Whether there will be others, I don't know, but it was to respond to some specific ocean disposal concerns down there. There may be other public meetings as well, and then they will take in the comments. All of that becomes part of the public record, and a final EIS feasibility study will be issued, we hope, by August or September of this year, if all were to hold.
Okay.
How might legislators be involved in that public review and comment? Has it been thought given to that particular piece of involvement?
Certainly, if you wanted to be on the mailing list, you wanted to be advised, I could have your name added. There's usually what they do is they issue a notice, or the court issues a notice, and they make it available. I believe it goes to libraries. It's available in the core library. There's a whole set of actions that the Corps takes to make it available.
Okay. Aside from notice, no other formal role?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Since there are some folks who came from more than long miles, I'd like to call them out of courtesy, make sure that we can hear and they can go home if they want to. Let me see, Fred Bojou, okay, thanks very much. And then also, who is Fred Nisburn? Are you from also the more than 100 miles? Okay. And then, okay, are you from yourself or did you come with someone else?
I came alone.
Okay.
You come with us from over 100 miles.
Okay, why don't you come on over?
Mm-hmm.
You are also Richard?
Richard Jefferson.
Okay, Richard Jefferson. And also John?
Westerhall,
also more than 100 miles away. And thank you very much for driving a long drive, and I do appreciate your time. Would you just state your name and proceed, please?
My name is Fred Bone, Senator Lim, members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to testify.
Okay. And why don't you testify?
Well, it's true that the ships are getting larger, but it's more true that the ships are not going to stop getting larger. The Regina Maersk is 6,000 TEUs and draws 50 feet fully loaded. The Maersk ship line has 12 of these in regular service now, with 3 more due next year. The next size ship that Maersk is going to use is 6,600 TEUs. There is a ship being built in South Korea, Samsung Heavy Industries, that is 8,770 TEUs. It's on the drawing boards. Construction is scheduled to start in the year 2000. This ship will draw 27 meters, roughly 80 feet. Now, we realize that there has been a 10-year study to deepen this river 3 feet, but we submit that the river is not getting deeper fast enough to meet the needs of the modern shipping, modern ships, and that at some point, Oregon has to, and the Columbia River has to invest in a seaport on the coast with deep water. Many of the we have, I believe there are six reasons that we should go ahead and vote for this bill, because it is a study only. It doesn't commit anyone to anything. One, it's an environmentally beneficial site for all dredge material. The current dredging plan dumps dredge material on fishing grounds at the mouth of the river. However, if this port at Astoria is adopted, it would require up to 30 million cubic yards of dredge material simply to create. So the problem with this bill is not too much dredge material, it's not enough. The next problem is the deeper draft of the new ships. The 10-year process to dredge 3 feet is too slow. The ships are getting deeper much faster. Much of the study was based on the Ogden-Beeman study of 1986, and Port of Portland has based many of their conclusions on this. It's a very thorough study, but they did not in 1986. They were completely wrong about how fast the ships were going to get bigger. Also, an advantage for Port of Portland is the opportunity for the building a new port with direct ship rail transfer. This is not being done on the West Coast, and this is the technology of taking the container and placing it directly on the rail car, directly under the container crane, and then sending it to its destination. It's more efficient, it's faster, and it's the way of the future, and we expect that if we build a port at Astoria that we can prepare for that and have it leg up on all the other West Coast ports. Also, building a port at Astoria would be a solution to Portland's growth expansion needs. Metro is being challenged in court because of their desire to expand their growth boundary. They've scheduled an appeal. They're preparing an appeal. We believe that if a port was built at Astoria, Hayden Island would not be necessary for the Port of Portland. There's 827 acres on Hayden Island that, if zoned residential at the highest Portland density, would produce 300,000 living units, which could double the population of Portland. This is a close-in expansion site that's much better than expanding the growth boundary out of the perimeter and clogging up the freeways. Also, there's a cost savings. Port of Portland is prepared to spend, I believe, $650 million to develop port facilities on Hayden Island. An estimate by the engineers proposing this port in Astoria is $350 million. Also, this is an opportunity, a port at Astoria, to increase the market share of the container business throughout the next century. As the ships get bigger, and if those ships will be excluded from the Columbia River, our market share has got to drop and diminish each year using Portland. If we have deep water at Astoria and can accommodate these larger ships, our market share has got to increase. This is an enormous shift of investment capital, but it's time to do it now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Richard.
Yeah. Well, for the record, Richard Gustafson, lifelong resident of Astoria and long-term and for 30 years. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator. I'll mark right through this. I'm not a public speaker, so I'll...
It's okay.
This is indeed a critical juncture for the Columbia River as an artery of commerce, and policy decisions made at the present will impact the region and nation for generations to come. At issue is whether the Columbia River port system shall be a major player in container shipping or will be further marginalized as a niche for bulk and grain. The stakes are enormous since we are strategically positioned to receive the trade with more than 3 billion people across the ocean. Some things we can say with certainty. After 10 years of study, the Corps proposes to deepen the channel to 43 feet. There is consensus among planners that 50 feet is the bare minimum for the large container ships in service in 1999, let alone the near future. There will be a continuation in the trend of increased tonnage being shipped in containers. improved intermodal facilities are required to serve the land bridge between the Orient and the heavily populated Midwest and Eastern part of this country. There is also a fairly recognized public safety issue in bringing ever larger ships 100 miles up a channel too narrow to allow an ample margin when two ships meet at a combined speed of 40 miles an hour. We have been blessed with excellent pilotage and dumb luck. There is only one locality in Oregon with the potential to safely accommodate the large container ships of the 21st century. It is possible to begin construction within the scope of the core channel deepening study. It is possible that, for an expenditure similar to the combined cost of channel deepening plus the Port of Portland's planned Hayden Island expansion, highway and rail improvements, and a terminal facility at Tongue Point can be accomplished. Such a facility could be built as part of a comprehensive planning process that should include replacing the obsolete Longview Bridge with a bridge or tunnel that includes rail, merging the various port authorities on both sides of the river with obvious benefits. A comprehensive view of the Plum River system doesn't require, contrary to some testimony you may hear, does not require relocating existing facilities down to Astoria. Although it is true that to locate a new grain or container facility at Hayden Island rather than Astoria is absolute folly. And how can I say that? I've witnessed the changes in ships and shipping for the past 30 years. During that time, I've worked in every port and every container facility in the Northwest. I say with absolute certainty that if we do not vigorously pursue a share of the container trade with far-sighted planning and action, then we are severely blowing it. There is little additional time to waste. During the 10 years while the Corps has been studying channel deepening, the Columbia system has fallen further behind the three container handling port areas on the West Coast. The fate of the region's most vital economic engine is very much in your hands. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? No? Okay. And John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I represent, John Westerholm is my name, and I represent Salmon for All and Columbia River Fishermen's Protective Union in Astoria, our commercial fishing organizations on the lower river. I also represent myself personally, and I represent salmon. I've been a commercial fisherman and a gill netter all my life, as well as other endeavors, until the last couple of years when I retired from education, Mr. Duncan. I led three lives. I was a farmer and a teacher and a fisherman. But the fishing came first because I grew up in that, and now I'm finishing up in that. But anyway, I feel like I speak not from the pocketbook, but from the heart. I mean, the river has been a part of me, and when I found out about the possible deepening of the channel again a few years ago, I immediately took a strong interest, and I've been involved in various meetings and so forth ever since. The study that the federal government is conducting, the Corps of Engineers, it seems to us on the lower river, is leaving some things out. It is not pursuing all of the options adequately. And we have made a strong appeal to mostly deaf ears from the Portland area, and although Richard made an inroad recently, but especially in regards to what damage is messing around with the lower river going to do to salmon. We watched while the dam building episode went on, and of course we didn't know for sure what was going to happen, and now we've got problems, and we're doing the best we can, everybody working together, to try to solve those problems from that point of view. But too many people are still carrying on business as usual, and as long as it doesn't bother my business, we'll do something to help save salmon. What I'm getting at is that it seems like we talked about education a few minutes ago and kids and schools, and you know what I'm talking about, that psychologically prevention is better than cure. I always believe that in as far as medicine is concerned, but also in raising kids, and in this case, in messing around with our fragile environmental Columbia River. The greatest salmon stream in the history of the world at one time certainly isn't anymore. And we feel that we've been willing to work with the Port of Portland as such, and the ports from upriver, to try to work something out. I've always said that, and we still are. But we think that maybe the state of Oregon needs to get into the act a little bit here, and that's why I'm speaking in favor of this Bill 1307. We feel that a top-loading port at some point, Astoria area, would be a plus for all the ports up and down the river, as Mr. Gustafson just said. And we think that's something worth looking into a little closer. We're not trying to run competition in the Astoria area with other ports, but we're trying to get a little something back there at the same time. And most importantly, we're trying to not do something that may require a cure in the future. We think it will be a plus for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? If not, we will appreciate taking time to get time. If you have any recent testimony, if you'd like to give us, and that we will sign as an official record, if you have it. Okay?
Sure, I have a 5 o'clock with Mr. Orloff within my office.
Okay.
I need to take off.
Thank you. Yeah. We will continue to have a public hearing as a subcommittee at this point, since we don't have a full member. At this time, I'd like to call the Karen Gordon Fleeter. Welcome, and also I'd like to call at the same time. Let me let the Karen. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
You know the time, and so appreciate this going into the point right away. Appreciate it.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Karen Godden, the Executive Director of the Pacific Northwest International Trade Association, commonly referred to as PNITA. PNITA is a membership-based organization that has one key objective, and that is to promote the economic being, well-being of Oregon and Pacific Northwest region through international trade, which is why I'm here today to urge very strongly that in the consideration of Senate Bill 1307, that we do not in any way delay moving forward on the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project. From the perspective of the business community and our members, we feel that a delay could economically harm the state, its economic competitiveness, both nationally and internationally. Mr. Chairman, as you will recall, a little over 2 months ago, I was joined by two colleagues when we talked about the strategic role that trade plays in the Oregon economy. And the message of that day is the same message today, and that is three major points. Trade is one of the critical drivers in Oregon's economic prosperity. It's even expected to grow in greater importance. And transportation is a trade competitiveness issue. It is not merely an infrastructure issue, because without the ability to move cargo seamlessly from vessels in our port and across the docks onto the freeways, barges, rails, cars, and planes, we put at risk the rest of the trade equation. The deepening of the Columbia River Channel is a vital link to keeping our main access to Asia competitive in the next century. And I should have pointed out from the outset, I do not have the technical expertise to address the issues in the bill. I am here to really represent our business interests of our members as well as the broader business community. And I'd like to share with you, this past week we had senior representatives from Korea and from China who not only came with the ambassador rank but also government and business people who were looking and talking with us at length about expanding trade in both areas.
And I know during those discussions with business people and with port authorities, there was great talk about the port facilities and the ability to move cargo to Asia on a very competitive basis. And it's with this in mind that I have the strongest message, and I will not take more of your time, and that is, let's move forward to keep Oregon economically strong. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions? If not, I have one question. You heard that I'm not expert also, hold on 1 second. I'm not expert on this issue at all, but I heard a testimony that the ship's getting bigger, and eventually we need 45 or 50 feet or more. What happened? Are we continue to channel deepening, and then do we need to look it up sometime in the future, more feasible places? You know, I'm for the channel deepening 40 to 43 feet. Where are we going to start it to accommodate this big ship?
I'm not familiar with some of the technical aspects of how quickly and what proportions of these ships. I've heard some statistics cited here that certainly would lead me to believe that everything is getting bigger, faster, but the proportion of that I'm not familiar with, so I would not be prepared. But I think it's important that we do not stop or delay our efforts where we know we have to go in hoping that in the future we can bank on that. Plus
okay.
Investment needed.
Okay. Thank you very much, Karen. Appreciate it. That's called the Fred Nifon Astoria. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Fred Newsom. I'm actually from Portland. I'm not from that story.
Oh, okay.
AORCA. Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, who I represent.
Thanks.
My name is Fred Newsom. Always, not just for the record. I always wonder why people say that, but it doesn't change. You may wonder why I'm here. My group, one of its main missions is to promote cost-effective, environmentally sustainable transportation. And most of the time we focus on public transportation and rail, passenger rail and so on. But we do get involved in the freight business because, especially when we're dealing with passenger rail, that's invariably tied with the rail freight network, and we have to work with those private partners and so on and so forth. And as we work on transportation elements in the metropolitan areas like Portland, we have to deal with movement of all kinds of freight, freight and people, and the interaction of all those and so on. And so we're here speaking very much in favor of Senate Bill 1307 because we think it makes sense to study a long-term solution to our trade needs. I've read quickly through some of the written testimony of people that have submitted here and they may be testifying after me. I certainly heard some of the testimony that came before me from folks that are opposed to this bill. I would suggest that what they're saying there is mainly an eloquent affirmation that we need to keep the maritime trade as a primary focus, as a main economic engine for our state and for the Pacific Northwest, and keeping our state positioned properly with regard to other West Coast ports. That does not mean that dredging of the Columbia River to 43 feet is necessarily the only possible solution to keeping us at that competitive position. And I think others before me have gone into greater detail about what's happening in the maritime business, larger ships, increasing sizes at a very rapid rate, so that when the Columbia gets dredged, and that's a big if now with the listing of the salmon and so on. And most of the EIS that the Corps is working on was done before the listing of the salmon, so it's unclear how they're going to address that whole issue. I'm not sure how they can get around it, really. But if that is still possible under the listing of the fish listings, there's no guarantee that that 43 feet won't be obsolete the day it's finally dug. One of the problems that the Corps ran into when they were doing their alternative analysis is that they assumed that the rail infrastructure would stay the same as it is now. And as you're probably aware, the rail industry, up until very recently, had been in a rather downward spiral. That has changed a lot since deregulation on the federal level and consolidation of rail lines and selling off of branch lines and so on. We now have a company in charge of the Astoria line that runs from Portland to Astoria, a company that's very aggressively working the freight market in the state, the Pacific or Portland and Western Railroad. And they are now at work in rebuilding that line to make it more effective. And in fact, that part of the line was washed out during the floods. And they're working in tandem with the state and the federal government to get that line up again. They're looking for freight markets, and they've done a very good job in other parts of the state where they're operating and taking lines that were close to abandonment and turning that around and having regular shippers and making a business out of it. So the whole transportation scene is changing. Not only are the ships getting bigger, faster, oh yes, I just got this note from that Astoria, the line will be open this week to Astoria. It hasn't closed for a couple of years. There currently is more interest in the rail industry on upgrading that line and being able to make that a first-class connection, land bridge. That was not taken into consideration at all by the Corps of Engineers. They took a look at a low-density rail line with some poor repair and said, well, gee, even if we did put something at Tongue Point, we'd never get the stuff out of there without building a six-lane freeway to haul the stuff out here, and it's impossible. Therefore, dredging is the only thing. So this bill is giving us an opportunity to really study that alternative in the manner that it ought to have been studied in the first place. And I don't see this as negating the core study, but it's just another piece that has to be added on. And so I appreciate this opportunity to
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, questions? If not, and we'll move on to the next person, Keith Levitt.
Yes.
Okay, Keith Levitt and Ken Armstrong. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. And what I'm passing out, Mr. Chair, is a piece that we prepared that deals with the 43-foot channel and the ship size issue. With regard to, I'm going to speak directly to Senate Bill 1307. We are against the bill. We're against it for the reasons that have been stated by several others before us. We've just completed a $6.1 million study to look at the feasibility of deepening the channel. That study included the Astoria alternative. The sponsors of the project include the Port of Astoria, as well as the other ports in Washington. And you might be interested to know that more tonnage comes from the state of Washington ports than does from the Oregon side of the river. So there's a major interest in a set of infrastructure on the Washington side that is looked at in this bi-state project. But we feel like we just spent 10 years and $6.1 million studying. The task force that you envision in Senate Bill 1307, probably the number one concern we have is that it says alternative to all dredging to Portland. And that came, in reading the bill, it came as a surprise to us because it was an either-or proposition, and it certainly brought up a lot of concern. I guess overall we are not at all opposed to studying port development in Astoria. There is a deep water port at Astoria. They have engaged in shipping in the past with the what has happened with the timber industry over the last several years, that has subsided. There is, the short line is hooked up now with Astoria. So there's no reason why the Port of Astoria can't come to the State Economic Development Department to begin a study of where they're going to be in the future in maritime commerce. But we do not want that to delay the channel deepening project. And we don't believe that you need a bill to do that. It's a local issue. There's a port commission that's elected locally, and they can come to the Economic Development Department, which has funds available for this type of a study. As well, Mr. Chair, you're aware of the Oregon Ports Advisory Council, which is a policy body to make recommendations on these types of issues to the legislature. That council has been working for 4 years and is focused on the coastal dredging issue, as you well know. That body is the type of body that could take on this type of study as well and oversee it. So, again, we're not opposed to looking at port development in Astoria. I would like to comment with regard to ship sizes to convey that all ships in the future are going to be at these mega ship levels, which are in the 6,000 to 8,000 TEU, is not correct. The recent study out of the United States Department of Transportation shows that in the Trans-Pacific trade, which and that information is in the memo I just gave to you, in the Trans-Pacific trade, by the year 2010, about 10% of the ships will be of these mega ships. But the vast majority of ships will be able to transit a 43-foot channel. They would have difficulty transiting a 40-foot channel, which is, again, why we have asked for the 43 feet. The Port of Portland does not see itself in competition as a major container hub port, and that's a legitimate thing for Astoria to look at. There would be a lot of challenges to a project like that and a lot of questions as to whether the state would want to subsidize all of that investment. But then we think that the Port of Astoria should be really the driving force behind that kind of an effort and not the legislature.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? If not, it's Ken.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Ken Armstrong, Executive Director of the Oregon Public Ports Association. To be honest with you, I've struggled just a little bit about what I was going to say about this bill, and I'm going to take a little bit different tack, I guess, than some of the other opponents to the legislation. I want to be very clear. The Oregon Public Ports Association does oppose Senate Bill 1307, and, in fact, the Port of Astoria, which is a member of the Oregon Public Ports Association, opposes this bill. I spoke with their interim director as early as this morning to clarify that point, and as Keith has already mentioned, there are some local processes at work here, and the local port does not support this legislation. I'm sure that the committee can appreciate the frustration of the Ports Association at seeing a bill this session, especially at this stage of the session, that jeopardizes one of our premier legislative priorities. We were not, however, consulted, contrary to earlier testimony, about any element of such a major policy shift. I can assure you that if this were an issue that were good for the state of Oregon, that were good for the ports industry, that were good for the Columbia River, from a port perspective, the Oregon Public Ports Association would be firmly behind this bill. In my view, this is being promoted by a group that's worked totally outside the process. They have not worked in good faith with other people that would be normal partners in this kind of an issue, and that's been very frustrating for us. I want to echo what Keith has said, that I want to be clear that the Ports Association does not in any way want to give the impression that we don't support doing a study for what some development alternatives might be at Astoria. We fully support that. But like Mr. Levitt has said, there are two very fundamental reasons why this bill is not needed. You don't need legislation to do a study. That can be done, and the Ports Association can assist with that. And there already is, in fact, a deep draft port at Astoria. And that's really all we have to say. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions? If not, okay. Thank you very much. Made a good point. Okay. Mike Dewey and also the... Mike Burton, going to come together.
Okay.
Okay. Welcome, Mike, again, and please give us a brief opinions on this, if possible.
Chairman Lynn, Senator Duncan, thank you for your patience. I'll be brief. I'm going to jump around a little bit on my testimony. For the record, I'm Michael Burton, Assistant Director of the Oregon and Port Liaison of the Oregon Economic Development Department. The department does not support Senate Bill 1307, primarily for three reasons. We're not really sure we understand the scope of the study indicated. However, if it's a study as was described by the Port Association and the Port of Portland, evaluation of the potential for a port that didn't get into a lot of real heavy environmental or engineering considerations, we have a mechanism in place to deal with that level of study now. That would be the Oregon Ports Advisory Committee and potentially the Oregon Port Revolving Fund. So there are ways for us to get at the project the way it sits. However, if the project involves intensive environmental examinations and some engineering for transportation infrastructure and the like, potentially the project could get very expensive, in which case we don't have the resources to support that. At that level, we'd be considering a legislative action to provide us the resources to deal with the study. We don't want that. The third consideration is we don't want that study to get in the way of the channel deepening project. That is critical to Oregon business throughout the state. It's something that's got a long timeline. It's moving through that timeline. We need to see that project completed the way it's already scheduled to be done. I've attached a brief fiscal impact statement with my comments. Brief because we don't really know the scope of the study as it's being projected. We think it could be fairly inexpensive and handled by staff. We think it could run to several hundreds of thousands of dollars. Because of the time, I'll let my comments
okay.
At that, and we'll be happy to answer questions.
Thanks for the testimony and the information. I appreciate it. Good night.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Huey, representing the Oregon Wheatgrowers League and also the Oregon Fair Commission. You do have a letter from the Oregon Wheatgrowers League, I believe, in your file, and also from the Oregon Potato Commission outlining their opposition to the bill. And I'm not here to read those. I know you can read probably better than I can. So I will just say very quickly, it's unfortunate there's not enough money to go around for a number of very good projects. The Columbia project is the lifeblood of both the wheat growers in the state and potato growers in terms of the amount of tons, if you will, bushels, if you will, the cargo loads that go out of the port. And we are very supportive of the channel deepening project, and monies have already been set aside for this, and we hope that that would continue. And unfortunately, we see this as a conflict, if you will, between financial resources. And if we had to pick one over the other, we would take the Columbia just because the infrastructure is in place. And the other side of the equation is it's not getting from Portland to Astoria necessarily. The key is getting from the other western states to the Port of Portland. And the Port of Portland, as you know, has a tremendous economic effect. I wish the people knew that in Portland and the surrounding areas, but the economic effect is so substantial that we would be concerned about that and the additional cost. So as we read the bill, we oppose it, but I'm sure there might be a middle ground Mr. Burton talked about.
Okay. Any questions? Appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
Okay. I think we have two more in the person would like to testify. Jonathan Luther, is he here? He left. Okay, then Jeff Watkins, maybe he left also. Okay, I guess then that's about it. Any other person like to testify on the Senate bill, the 1307? If not, we will close the public hearing. It's been until 13:07. If there's no business, my friend is already leaving, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you for your patience, your time. We do appreciate it. Thank you. What's the security information?